I'm Tony Cox, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm sitting in for Michelle Martin. Coming in, increasing tension as Section 8 housing vouchers have helped some blacks and Latinos move into white neighborhoods. We'll talk about why local officials are pushing back in some cases. More on that in a few moments. But first, hackers have launched a second strike against transit police in San Francisco. Members of the group Anonymous infiltrated the website of the Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART, police union on Wednesday and posted personal information about several officers. Both hacker attacks were in retaliation for BART's decision to cut off cell phone coverage in four underground metro stops last week. That move was the agency's attempt to disrupt a planned protest sparked by the killing of a homeless man by a BART officer in July. Now a debate is raging over whether BART went too far by interfering with wireless access. Did this violate protesters' rights or protect public safety? To talk more about this, we are joined now by James Temple. He is a technology reporter and commentator for the San Francisco Chronicle. He writes the column Dot Commentary. We are also joined by Lee Tien. He is a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That's an organization that specializes in free speech in the digital age. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
We are going to begin with this. BART has so far continued to defend its decision, saying it acted in the interest of public safety. Here's a clip from BART spokesperson Linton Johnson at a press conference earlier in the week.
This was not a choice that we wanted to make. We were forced into this decision by the protesters. Remember, and I want to make this clear, BART loves free speech.
James Temple, according to the Associated Press and our own research here, this is the first time authorities in this country have shut off wireless access to prevent a demonstration. What was the range of reaction in the Bay Area to BART shutting down cell phone coverage the way that it did?
Sure. Well, it definitely covered the map. If you look at the comment section on any of the stories we've written about it, they go all over the place from a lot of frustrated transit riders who thought, you know, protesters had no business blocking, disrupting service in response to this, to, you know, people generally just standing up for what BART, the actions of BART police, to, of course, plenty of commentators and commenters on the site and in free speech groups, et cetera, who say that BART had no business shutting down the cell phone service, that it was a clear violation of the First Amendment.
Lee Tien, you are representing one of the groups that was very critical of BART's move. Explain what your complaint exactly is.
Well, thanks very much. The basic complaint is that BART squelched a lot of people's speech before they ever had a chance to speak. And in the world of First Amendment law or free speech law, that's called a prior restraint. And it's the most, it's the gravest and most serious encroachment on speech rights, worse than, say, punishing speech after the fact.
Are there ever extenuating circumstances? And if so, what do you think BART should have done in this case?
Well, first of all, it's not an absolute prohibition against prior restraints. So, yeah, there are extenuating circumstances. But probably the most important point here is that BART took the law into its own hands by turning off the cell phone service. And ideally, they probably should have gone to a court to get an order permitting them to do so.
Let me just say that we did reach out to BART for comment several times, as a matter of fact, to join the conversation, but we have not yet had a response. Lee, let me ask you a follow-up. Do you think that as a result of the action taken by BART, that there is likely to be some sort of legal response from those who are opposed to what BART did to prevent the organization from being able to do this again?
Well, right now, I am told that groups like the ACLU are not planning to sue over this right now, and my understanding is that my organization isn't either. On the other hand, I have heard that the Federal Communications Commission is looking into the incident as well as the general question of emergency emphasis on making sure that this doesn't happen again.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. We are talking about how law enforcement is having to adapt to the digital age. Our guests are Lee Tien of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and James Temple, a technology reporter and columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. James, to that point, you have been writing columns, and one in particular where you said everyone was stupid. I'm sort of paraphrasing a little bit. What has been the response? First of all, tell us why you took that position, and secondly, tell us what the response to your column has been.
Sure. Well, I mean, my point here was just that that there's sort of plenty of criticism to go around. You know, I do think that BART that it's fair to say that BART overstepped, and that it was, especially in light of the fact that there never really ended up being much of a protest on the day that they made this move. You know, it ended up looking like it took this overly aggressive step for no particular reason. So, you know, and I seriously question the effectiveness of the policy as a demonstration deterrent. You know, if you have a whole bunch of people show up intent on causing chaos, I think they're going to succeed at that whether or not they can log into their Twitter account. So as a practical matter, I think BART should have thought twice about whether it wanted to pick a First Amendment fight over this issue. But, you know, on the other hand, I also made the point that there are a lot of people that are kind of taking firm positions and saying one side is Group A is right and Group B is a horrible monster, and I just think that there's plenty of scolding to go around. You know, the demonstrators, you know, as we ended up reporting, you know, the demonstrators in the last protest, it did get somewhat out of hand. There were about 100 protesters that took part. They shoved BART security officers. One man climbed on top of a train. Someone blocked the doors of a train. There were people in masks that were hammering on ticket machines. So, you know, however else they might portray it, this wasn't some sort of MLK-style peaceful sit-in here. And then, of course, the hacking groups, and particularly this hack that happened yesterday, are pretty hard to defend on any grounds, where they've now leaked the personal information of BART riders, and now the personal addresses of the BART police officers. And I should point out here that Anonymous took credit for the first hacking. I don't think at this point, at least the last story I read, they had in the second case. It seems like from a colleague of mine reported that it was someone who had identified herself as a French girl who taught herself computer programming.
I read that.
And that was her first hacking.
I read that. I want to talk about that more with Lee Tien, as a matter of fact. But let me go back to the actions of the second hacking. And we are also told, as a matter of fact, it's reported in the Chronicle's website today that there is another protest planned possibly for Monday, this coming Monday. This group that hacked in and gave out the information of officers, do you think that's going too far also, Lee Tien?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't have any, you know, disagreement with the, you know, James's point that there's a whole lot of blame to go around. I mean,
So where does this lead us?
Behavior all around.
Where would you say, Lee Tien, this is leading us? BART takes an action. First of all, there's a person who was shot. There's an expected protest. BART takes an action to prevent the protest from becoming whatever it thought it might turn out to be. People are upset. Hacking takes place. And then a second group of hacking takes place. Where are we headed with this?
Well, this is democracy. We have plenty of disputes and disagreements about things, and we have a continuing, hopefully, peaceful social dialogue that goes on about this.
Well, would
obviously,
you?
It isn't always peaceful, and it isn't always just pure dialogue. It's often speech mixed with action. You know, that's what protest marches are. That's what rallies are. Indeed, you know, throughout history, political controversies accompanied by all sorts of things like that. You know, you don't have to go very far back to think about violence or riots during the civil rights movement, as well as very peaceful sit-ins.
Well, I've got about 30 seconds for this question and answer, Lee, and it's whether or not the technology has so far outstripped law enforcement that law enforcement is having to find ways and is behind the curve on how to deal with this digital crime.
Yeah, I don't really think so, quite honestly. Technology helps the police as well. They also have cell phones. They also are able to coordinate. And the other important point is that public safety isn't simply on the side of, say, shutting down communication service. Being able to communicate with each other, being more connected and wired, that's also good for the public safety.
It'll be interesting to see, James Temple, how the community in San Francisco and beyond actually responds to this. And we'll see whether or not this planned protest actually takes place this coming Monday and what BART's response to it will be on that day. James Temple, a reporter and columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, Lee Tien, a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, both joining us by phone from the Bay Area. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, you know the motto, rain, snow, sleet, or hail won't stop the mail. But what if 120,000 jobs are lost due to budget constraints and technology?
Even if your internet service provider shuts down, the post office is still there to deliver your mail to a government-protected mailbox.
What these tight economic times mean for the U.S. Postal Service, that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox.
If your wallet's bulging, well, maybe you're rich. Maybe you just have a lot of credit cards. For a lot of people, it's a pile of crumpled receipts taking up all that space. Of course, you can never find that one receipt when you need it most. Well, some retailers have a high-tech solution to your problems. Gigi Duban reports.
It all happens so fast. You've been waiting in the checkout line. Then, finally, it's your turn.
You're going to get back $10 and a nickel.
And just when you think you're through, the sales clerk pops the question.
And can I have your email address, please? All righty. And this is your receipt. You can look for special deals in your email address now. And we will also send you a receipt of this purchase.
More retailers, like this Old Navy store in Birmingham, Alabama, are emailing receipts to customers. Other stores like Nordstrom and Patagonia do the same. Sometimes it's instead of a paper receipt, but most of the time, customers get both. Apple has been doing this for years now. This summer, Gap Inc., which owns Old Navy and Banana Republic, launched e-receipts at more than 2,600 stores. Shelley Perlmutter is Gap's Vice President of Customer Relations Management. She says e-receipts are convenient.
We saw a number of people coming in with wallets stuffed with old receipts. And returns can sometimes be a hassle for someone who's time-starved. So we just thought, let's think of a way to make this more convenient and streamlined for the customer and also go a little bit greener.
Saving paper is really more like a bonus. The driving force is actually branding. Ilya Masaritsky is with Seamless Receipts, a company that designs e-receipts.
It's an opportunity to connect with their customers, to participate on the social networks, to review their products, to visit their sites, to read their news.
Sometimes users have to opt in for such marketing programs. With Seamless e-receipts, that can be as easy or accidental as clicking on a graphic in the e-receipt. At Gap Inc. stores, once you give the sales clerk your email address, you're automatically opted in. Company officials say you can always opt out later. But like reward cards, e-receipts give retailers another way to track shopping behavior. And that's worth money. If a company knows how you shop, it knows which products to push to your email inbox and when. Just outside that Old Navy store in Birmingham, Jillian Houston loads up her twin toddlers into her SUV and whips out her BlackBerry. What happens next seems, to her, almost magical.
They say your receipt. Okay, I received one. A confirmation showing that I did purchase and what items I did purchase. So I guess old baby does work.
This was Houston's first e-receipt. She says she likes that it won't fade. She's not too worried about spam. She keeps a separate email address for shopping and online contests. And experts say if keeping up with multiple accounts isn't your thing, you can always just say no. For NPR News, I'm Gigi Dubin in Birmingham.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know that TV show about being smarter than a fifth grader? I want to introduce you to two kids who are just entering the fourth grade this year, who are going to give those fifth graders a run for their smarts. They're two winners of the Kids Science Challenge. That's a competition put together by the creator of the Pulse of the Planet radio program, you know, veteran Jim Metzner. But instead of a robot competition like FIRST Robotics, this one challenges kids to, in the third to sixth grades, to think about a problem, a question, a need that science could solve. And then the winners get paired up with a science mentor, a scientist, to explore their idea and find the solution. You can find out more about it or learn how to enter next year at kidsciencechallenge.com. And we have two of the winners with us here today. Mary Benjamin will be entering the fourth grade at Pine Cobble School in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Her entry was the winner in the Sensational Sounds category of Kids Science Challenge. Welcome to the program, Mary.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to have you. Peyton Robertson, incoming fourth grader at Pinecrest School in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. His idea was the winner in the Super Stuff for Sports category. Welcome, Peyton.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. If you're a kid with an idea, you'd like to talk with our kids, our number is 1-800-989-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry at SCI. FRI. Mary, let me begin with you. Tell us about your project. What was that?
Well, I took two spray bottles, or two or three or four, or something like that, and I pretty much just sprayed water into a tin can, and the tin can had a tube attached to it, and it led back into the spray bottle, so you would never run out of water.
Hmm. And you were making a musical instrument?
Yeah.
By spraying the tin can and, I guess, changing the sound by how? How did you change the different sounds the can would make?
We found different kinds of cans, and we also tuned them a little bit by putting pressure on them, because you can tune tin cans if you put pressure on them, they become higher. Also, if the tin cans have bigger ridges on the bottom, then they're higher too.
Hmm. All right, we have actually a little bit of music that you played for us on your tin can. Let's have a listen. That's Ode to Joy, is it not?
Yep.
I could recognize that. That's very good. Peyton, you had a different project. What was your project?
I love golf. I play golf every weekend. And my idea was to create a ball warmer, which would preserve the golf ball's temperature so it doesn't lose distance. Because from my experiment, I noticed that a golf ball doesn't fly as far when it's cold.
So you made a ball warmer, a golf ball warmer. How does that work?
Well, we never actually made it, but here's what I thought it would look like. I thought it would be like a thermos technology. So it would be a vacuum flask, and there would be four or five different compartments. Each compartment would hold a ball. And you would and it would keep the ball's temperature. It would keep the ball's temperature the same. So in the cold parts of the country, the performance could still be consistent.
And what kind of research did you do in preparing for this?
Well, I cracked open several golf balls.
That's not an easy thing to do, cracking open.
Well, my parents helped me. I also Googled how golf balls are made.
Right.
And I heated 10 balls on, my parents heated 10 balls on the stove. We kept 10 at room temperature, and I put 10 in the freezer, and then we dropped all 30 of them off the top of a ladder, and we measured how high they bounced, and the hot and the room temperature balls bounced significantly higher than the cold balls.
Wow, you did a real science experiment there. Then you collected data, you did the experiment, an idea, and it all worked out. Is there a product here you think it can market something that keep golf balls a little higher to work well? And does it violate any golfing rules when you do that?
Heating it in like a microwave is not legal, but we're pretty sure that just keeping the temperature constant is legal.
Did you actually try to hit some golf balls or have them hit at all at a higher temperature? Did they go any further, or could you discover anything about them? You'd bounce them, and that was high enough, I guess.
When we went to my reward for winning was to go to the University of Southern Mississippi, and I met Dr. Savin, and we made some golf balls out of a super elastic polymer.
Right.
That would perform well at any temperature.
Wow.
And I got to hit those balls, and they definitely went further than regular balls.
All right, Titleist, watch out. Mary, how did you get your idea to work on this?
It's kind of a funny story. I was really running out of time to come up with an idea. I had come up with ideas for both the other categories, but I had no idea for this one. It was going to be very difficult to come up with an idea. But I thought about what they had said about thinking about something that no one would really guess could be a musical instrument. And then I looked around my room, and the first thing that I saw was a spray bottle, which I used to clean my guinea pig cage. And then pretty much the idea just popped into my head. And I went downstairs. I said, "Dad, I have an idea." I did a couple experiments, and that was pretty much it.
It's interesting that you were not afraid to tell people about your idea, that you might be afraid they might laugh at you.
Not really.
Yeah.
I didn't really tell, I kind of told them about my idea, but I wasn't really allowed to tell them that I had won. So it was hard to explain everything.
Yeah. Do you think someone else will build your idea and market it?
I don't know, but my aunt is a musician, and she said that she might use it in one of her concerts. So
wow.
That's pretty cool.
Did you have to experiment with different kinds of objects to find out which one made the best sound?
Yeah. We decided, I built two prototypes before I went to California, which is where I got to go because I won. And before I went there, I built two prototypes. They didn't look very much like the final product, but and I had to do a lot of experimenting with which sounds worked best until I decided that tin cans were what worked.
I have a question for both of you. Actually, it was one that I was going to ask, but came in a tweet from Baby Lou, who says, "What do you say to kids who think science is boring and useless? What do you say to them?"
I didn't always love science. You just gotta experiment. You have to come up with fun activities that you can do yourself that you learn from and that are very entertaining. And pretty much after that, you just kind of love science.
Mm-hmm. Peyton, do you have an answer for that?
I think that you shouldn't think about it as science. You should think about it as how things work, because if you think about it that way, then it becomes much, much more interesting.
Just don't call it science. Just try to figure out how the world works.
Right.
Do you have a follow-up? Do you have any other idea you're working on now?
Not really. Just I hope to make a prototype of my ball warmer, but besides that.
Yeah. Some other idea, and we'll hit you. And Mary, do you have any improvement that you can make or a follow up?
I've been kind of thinking about that. I've been experimenting with the one that I built,
mm-hmm.
and trying to come up with ways to make it better. So it's kind of an interesting project. I'm like drawing pictures of ways that it could become more interesting. The one that I built is portable. We used Velcro to make it. But it's so pretty big, so I'm trying to come up with a way that maybe next time it'll be more portable.
Let me ask you both. What do your friends say about what you're doing?
Well, I haven't talked to them in a while. I've been away for most of the summer, but was allowed to tell them right before school ended. But they seem pretty excited, interested. When I went to California, they put lots and lots of questions on my blog the questions that they had that I could think about when I built it, and then maybe I could answer them.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time with us, and good luck to you, too. Mary Benjamin of Williamstown, Massachusetts, Peyton Robertson of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Two winners of the Kids Science Challenge. You can find out more about that at kidsciencechallenge.com or go to our website. Good luck to you both, and thanks for coming on Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You. Hope to see you on your next project. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Earlier this week, Google snatched up Motorola Mobility to the tune of $12.5 billion. Google already makes an open-source mobile phone operating system, Android, so this would appear to give Google the opportunity to manufacture its own branded phones running on its own software, right? Well, maybe not, because Google's been downplaying the manufacturing aspect of the deal, pointing instead to Motorola's tens of thousands of patents as motivation for the acquisition. But you can't help but wonder, is Google getting into the mobile phone business? Is it ready, willing, and able to challenge Apple and the iPhone iPad juggernaut? How worried should Apple be, if at all? Might we see not just Google smartphones, but tablets also? If competition is good, then maybe we all win in this deal. What do you think? Do you like the Google gobble of Motorola? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Glenn Fleischman is a contributor to the Economist.com Babbage blog. He's also a writer for the online news site Tidbits and the Seattle Times. He joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday, Glenn.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your take on the deal? Why did Google do this?
Well, I think the focus has been on patents, and Google missed out on the Nortel patents a few weeks ago, where Apple, RIM, and Microsoft formed a consortium and sort of snatched that away from them. And I think Motorola is the other low-hanging fruit from the patent side. They need a defensive portfolio of patents because otherwise they're not doomed, but they're in a position where they have to have some strength to defend themselves. This is all kind of, you know, people sitting around at a table and you look at the stacks of paper and say, whose stack is bigger? Motorola has 24,500 patents underway or given to them, already assigned. And that's a big portfolio to help leverage what Microsoft, Apple, RIM, and all the other companies, yeah. Nokia, Qualcomm, everyone else in the space has.
What strength do all these patents give you in practical terms?
It's defensive, really. I mean, these companies, you know, you can see cases in which one firm wants to prevent another from going to market with something, like Apple trying to keep Samsung tablets off the market in Europe. But really, the companies don't benefit from trying to keep products off the market. They need to compete in the market. There's a competitive advantage there, but then they can be the victim of the same approach. So this is kind of a nuclear war. You don't really want to do a first strike because if you do, you know that there's all this other retaliation, including from other member states, not the first worlds.
But it's hard to deny the idea now that, you know, Google has an Android operating system and now it has access to all these patents. Why not go the Apple route, make the hardware and the software for it?
Well, and that's exactly what they've got to do now. I mean, they didn't buy, you know, I made this joke the other day that Google woke up and said, oh, we just acquired 20,000 employees along with the 25,000 patents. And Google hasn't been a hardware company. They've had other companies make hardware. They've been at a few removes from it. And it shows, you know, Apple controls everything from start to finish. Even though they have a contractor make their products, they work very, very closely with them. And only one company or companies make Apple products. There's no licenses. Mm-hmm. So Google has the opportunity to make something that is a completely realized version of their vision of what a mobile phone or mobile tablet should be and control every stage of the process. No one else can gainsay what they want to do.
Does that mean that they're going to clamp down on this open source Android platform?
It's very tricky. Once you let the open source cat out of the bag, you can't put it back in. The nature of people think about open source as being free and unlicensed, but it's not. There's very stringently defended licenses beneath most open source code, as distinct from free software that is license free. So Android, once it's been released, there are discussion that Amazon might come out with its own tablet. Amazon could take everything that is Android up until some moment and say, well, we're going to take this and modify it and not call it Android. We'll use all the same code and call it the Amazoid tablet operating system, and they'd be perfectly within their rights to do so. So there is still the potential for competition from companies taking the Android source code and making their own versions going forward.
So we might see a battle of all these cell phone makers and tablet makers boiling down to the big three.
That's what it feels like right now. We've got Apple, we have Microsoft, we have Google, and HP just took itself out of the running yesterday, which is, you know, it's baffling because they haven't lost that much money in relative terms to what they could gain if they actually got a foothold in the tablet or smartphone world. But yeah, three big companies and they're enormous and no one could really reach the scale to compete against them now because they're so entrenched in the marketplace.
Google, as we say, has had Android, but is Android is it in some way in danger of losing its market?
Well, it could because Google, till now, has been licensing it, has been, you know, Android itself is free as an operating system. If you're a Microsoft customer, if you're a Nokia, for instance, you pay some fee to use the phone. Android, you don't pay a fee as a cell phone maker to use it. But Google's controlled the Android name. You can't call it an Android without their approval, controlled access to the application marketplace, the Android market. Controlled access to Google apps and services like driving directions. So there has been that level of control, but they've got HTC, LG, Samsung, and Motorola. Other companies have all, dozens and hundreds of smaller ones, have all licensed Android and put it into the marketplace. And the question is, do they want to compete against a Google-owned hardware company?
Right.
I don't think anyone has a clear answer yet. They don't know. If you look at there's a page of quotes at Google's site from all of their partners, their Android partners, and it reads like the Stepford Wives. So these quotes were very happy. If you read this, this is the ultimate public relations issue where Google said, hey, would you say something like we're really happy about the defensive action that this acquisition represents. And HTC says, we are very happy about the patent acquisition defensive position, page and page of quotes like that.
You know what the irony here is, as someone who's watched this business for 40 years, is that Apple used to get killed by people, its competitors, saying, why are you in the hardware business? Right? And they even went out of the, they even actually licensed their hardware for a little bit. Didn't work out very well, but kept, you know, saying when you buy a Mac or an Apple, you're buying the hardware as well as the software, and people laughed at them. And now they're all coming back to that side.
Yeah, well, it used to be you couldn't make something good enough and cheap enough to compete in the marketplace. And Apple has figured out how to sell enough products at high enough margin that they have this $75 billion plus cash war chest, and they can buy every tablet screen of the quality they want for the next 5 years from the companies that make it and all their competitors that are paying a higher cost for lower quality components. So Apple used to be, you know, it was the high cost product, and now an iPad is actually relatively cheap for the features it delivers compared to any of the competitors on the market. That's a tricky competitive position to be in.
So what do you think Apple's take in their boardroom is now on this decision? Are they just are they saying we welcome your challenge and just, you know, try to take us on, or what?
I think they're laughing and laughing and rolling around in piles of dollar bills, because this is the affirmation of so many years of Apple strategy. This is the ultimate confirmation. They're the biggest or second biggest company in the world by stock market capitalization. Their competitors have fallen by the wayside. Microsoft won't have a tablet till next year. This is going to affect the Android market, even if Motorola produces a fantastic tablet under Google's guidance. So Apple says, I guess everything we did turned out right, didn't it?
Let me get a quick phone call in. John in Concord, North Carolina. Hi, John.
Hope this comes through okay on a headphone, but you know, I have dealt firsthand with Google Docs and Google Mail, and was totally disappointed in their support. I just hope their support, if they do start building hardware, is going to be better than it is for Google Docs and Gmail.
Good point. Thanks, John. What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, it's a real issue. I mean, Apple has this huge advantage of, again, the thing that everyone laughed at them for, all these retail stores, but now they have hundreds of places around the U.S. and hundreds more around the world where you can go in. You have a problem with the phone, you go in there and they go, my wife's had to go in with her phone. Everyone, you know, has a story about if they have a problem. You go in there and say, something's wrong with this, and under warranty, they say, you're right, here's another phone, see you later. Just plug it into your computer and it's back up and running. And it's having a single infrastructure, having that hands-on touch. I've had to send my laptops back to Apple, and there's no questions asked. And 2 days later, I get either a new one or it's completely replaced when it's under warranty. And that will go a long way. That goes a long way. Google doesn't like people very much, has always been my impression. They want to keep people arm's length away and let the algorithms, the automatic things, the user support forums handle everything.
Well, you know, we're entering the school buying season and the holiday buying season when we typically see all the new hot stuff coming out. Could Apple throw down the gauntlet this fall and say, yeah, okay, Google, try to match this with some who knows what kind of iPad or iPhone coming out?
Yeah, well, there were rumors that they might come out with yet another model of iPad, maybe a higher resolution screen in the September-October timeframe. There's clear evidence. In fact, some of the cell carriers have said openly there's another iPhone. The iPhone Model 5 will be coming out in that timeframe. And Android will have a new version of their operating system, 4.0 Ice Cream Sandwich, the code name, will be out around
them
as well.
Ice Cream Sandwich.
They like food at Google. Current release.
I've been there. I've seen
Honeycomb.
They got great cafeteria over there.
They put up giant icons of all these things too. There'll be a giant ice cream sandwich out on the front lawn there soon. But the question is, you know, their partners are making good hardware, and the Android operating system is quite good. Apple's borrowing things liberally in the next release of its iOS for iPhones. It's very clear, no question. But the issue is Apple has something that's so monolithic. There's one model. There's one thing you buy. You just go and you plug it in, and that's what it is. The question is that so compelling that people don't want the choice of looking around out of, you know, hundreds of other products that have different features?
Today, making an Android app isn't as simple as making an iPhone app, because there's so many different Android phones. You think now that that's going to change, that we're going to have more with Android being controlled?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what Motorola Mobility brings to the table for Google, is they could release a set of 5 or 10 or 20 phones, but they're all going to work in exactly the same way for developers. And right now, that's not true. Even from a single handset or tablet maker, you don't know that the same device, the same Android device as a programmer, will function the same way. And if you look at, like, Netflix has only been able to release its software for a handful of Android phones.
All right. Well, we know we're making a, you know, we make an Android app on Science Friday, and we know the difficulties on all the different phones.
Right.
Getting them to play the same on all the different phones is not easy. All right. Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for the insight.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be following you, and we'll be back. Okay? Stay by
Thank
the
you.
Phone. Glenn Fleischman is a contributor to TheEconomist.com. Babbage Blanc is also a writer for Tidbits and the Seattle Times. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to change gears and talk about this. What happened in San Francisco and the loss of the cell phones being shut off and the verbal storm that has ensued and people talking about it. We'll allow you to talk about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
It's probably happened to you. Your phone, laptop, or iPad is running out of power and you've left your charger at home, or you're too far from an outlet and the screen goes black until you can plug it in again. But what if you could power up just by turning the screen toward the sun or an indoor light? That day may not be far off, thanks to a team of researchers at UCLA, led by Professor Yang Yang. He joins me now from UCLA. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you.
So explain to me how this technology that you've developed would work.
All these electronic gauges has display and a display, typically we call LCD or liquid crystal display. It works like there are two pieces of polarizers that filter the light, and then the liquid crystal molecule work as a switch to turn the light on and off. And the polarizer is unfortunately a very energy inefficient device. It automatically filter or cut off 50% of the light. That's how it works. So our invention is to recycle the light that has been wasted during the process.
So you're actually going to recycle the light that's been given off by the screen but wasted.
That's part of the function, yes. But in the meantime, as you described earlier, we can actually position the device under the sunlight or room light. So it behaves as a solar cell, which can generate electricity from the light externally.
And charge the battery in that way.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. What kind of consumer device would be best suited for this technology?
Any device that requires a display. For example, the iPhone or even the desktop monitor, LCD TV. So those devices, displays, requires polarizers can actually utilize our invention.
Mm-hmm. How close is this technology to making its way to the market?
I hope that technology can reach the market in the next 5 years, but it's very challenging because of the technology successful in the laboratory compared to commercialization is a completely different approach.
What are the major obstacles that you need to overcome before it comes to market?
If you look at the TV or your cell phone image, they are pretty high quality today. Then some of them even 3D quality. We don't want to downgrade the image quality. So that's the major challenge that I can imagine.
Professor Yang Yang teaches materials science at UCLA. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, you are very welcome.
This is NPR News.
Kevin Mitnick was 12 years old when he realized he could talk his way to glory, or at least free bus rides.
One day it occurred to me, if I could punch my own transfers, the bus rides wouldn't cost anything. I walked to the front of the bus and sat down in the closest seat to the driver. When he stopped at a light, I said, "I'm working on a school project, and I need to punch interesting shapes on pieces of cardboard. The punch you use on the transfers would be great for me. Is there some place I could buy one?"
Kevin Mitnick did buy one of those punches. It was the first step in a career in trickery that would eventually land him in federal prison for hacking into the computers of several big phone and tech companies. He tells that story and many more in a new memoir, Ghosts in the Wires, My Adventures as the World's Most Wanted Hacker. Kevin Mitnick joins me now from our New York bureau. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Let's clear up some myths about you right away. You never tried to hack into Christy McNichols, the TV actress's phone?
No. That was crazy because in that story, the first time I found out about it is I was in a supermarket and they actually had one of those tabloids. And I was like in the front page of this tabloid. Obsessed stalker hacker is stalking Christy McNichol, and it's my photo, right? And I'm going, oh my God, you know, and I'm reading the story, and I just couldn't believe that this tabloid would just take a story invented out of whole cloth and put it on the newsstands. I was just shocked and appalled.
So let's talk about some of the things that you did do. After you figured out how to get free bus rides all over the city, you began hacking into the phone company. What was it about the phone company that you were so fascinated with?
Well, when I was in high school, I met this student who could kind of work magic with the telephone. And as a young boy, I was fascinated with magic. And he could do all these sorts of tricks, like he can call a secret number and put in a secret code, and he can call anywhere in the world. Where he would call like Australia and listen to the time. And he could like get my mom's non-published number. And all this stuff he was doing was I was thinking, ooh, I could do the same stuff, but make it like a magic trick. So then I became involved in phone freaking, it was called. Mm. It was like the predecessor to hacking. And then as the phone companies started evolving in their technology and becoming more computerized, I became involved in hacking the phone company.
And was it the power that the telephone company had?
It wasn't really about the power. I would say it was a lot more about the exploration and then the ability to do things to pull practical jokes. You know, it's like calling the bowling alley and asking them, well, do you have 10-pound balls? You know, well, how do you walk around? You know, so it's the type of, you know, juvenile type of pranks that I love to pull by having the ability to get in the telephone company's network.
And it was like solving a puzzle.
Exactly. And I loved figuring my way around obstacles. And later in life, I would intentionally put myself in dangerous situations, like running from the government, because at one point I was a fugitive. I'd intentionally put myself in these dangerous positions and then try to figure out how to get out of it. It became like a game to me, but unfortunately with real consequences.
We're talking with Kevin Mitnick. He wrote the book Ghost in the Wires, My Adventures as the World's Most Wanted Hacker. Throughout the whole book, there's a lot of computer wizardry. There's a lot of telephone wizardry. But a lot of it is just plain old conning your way into getting information out of people's minds. You called this social engineering throughout the book. What is this?
Well, social engineering is using manipulation, deception, and influence tactics to get somebody to comply with a request.
Like what?
Like giving out a password, for example, even though I rarely used that form of social engineering. It was usually to get somebody to do some sort of action item. You know, no, go ahead, Sally, and I need, we're installed a new upgrade to the password changing program, and I need you to test it. And then I'd have the target change her password to something I knew. Like, oh yeah, just for the test, let's change your password to test 1234. And by the way, do not give me your old password. And I'd lecture the person on security guidelines that you should never, ever give out your password. I'd have them change it to something that I suggested. And then I'd have them test their applications. And when they were testing everything, I was already into that person's account.
How did you get them to do this?
By just pretending to be from the IT department. And sounding, using the correct terminology and lingo that they expected, and just sounding like one of the in-group.
What is some of the information that you were able to obtain over the years? I mean, a lot of people, you really scared a lot of people with your abilities. And what were some of the things that freaked them out the most?
I think one of the maybe incidents that, you know, freaked out government investigators is when I hacked into a cellular phone provider in Los Angeles, and I was tracking the FBI's movements. At the time, the FBI was chasing me. So by hacking into Pactel Cellular, I was able to get access to the call detail records and find out who was calling the government agents and who were they calling? What were their physical locations to try to get a sense of what they knew about me and what their next move was?
That is a little bit scary. I mean, it, for you, it was a game of cat and mouse, but for FBI agents whose, you know, lives are on the line against drug cartels or violent criminals, having that information out there could be very dangerous to them.
Well, I guess it's fortunate that I wasn't a violent criminal or drug dealer. I was a nonviolent hacker, and I would have never passed this information to anybody else. I basically used it to try to evade them. It wasn't aggressive in any means of the word.
I mean, in all the hot water that you've gotten in over the years, I mean, you spent so much time on the run, and you spent years in prison. You kept doing it, even though you kept getting caught.
Well, the only thing I could think of is it was just, you know, it was kind of an addiction. You know, it was a passion and an addiction, and I just loved doing it, and it's what I knew.
One of the things that really jumped out in the book is that, you know, throughout this process, you never really used any of these techniques to make any money.
Exactly. I mean, my motivation for, you know, hacking was all about the intellectual challenge, the seduction of adventure, and most importantly, the pursuit of knowledge. I just wanted to learn everything there was. The hacker ethic is you never try to make money from it, and you never try to harm or destroy.
That's the hacker ethic?
Well, that was at my time, you know, during the old school. Nowadays, that trend has changed, where now we hear about hacking, targeting credit card numbers, bank accounts, identity theft, organized crime, leveraging hacking skills to do their dirty deeds. Back in my day, you know, there was the hacker ethic. It was all about learning, exploring, and adventure.
Do you miss doing it sort of illegally?
No. I mean, I do it today, and I break into systems all the time, but I do it with authorization. So I have clients all around the world that, you know, hire me to break in, and I get the same type of endorphin rush, and I have the same type of enjoyment that I experienced when I was a hacker.
Hacker turned computer security expert Kevin Mitnick. His new book is Ghost in the Wires. Thanks, Kevin, so much for coming in.
Hey, thank you. It's been a pleasure.